and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Ellie Gelder. So 2 weeks ago, the announcement came that the majority of the UK voted to come out of the EU. We're now in unprecedented territory with politicians divided as to the correct way forward and leadership contests hotting up. It's going to take time to understand the full impact of Brexit, with Article 50 yet to be invoked to formally exit the EU. However, as a business owner or HR practitioner, you're likely to be wondering how this will affect UK employment law as we know it. As well as the considerable distraction of Brexit, there's also plenty of other activity in the employment law field that HR practitioners will need to keep abreast of. Upcoming legislation in relation to gender pay gap reporting and the apprenticeship levy means that many employers will need to start preparing now. We're also expecting the recently enacted Trade Union Act to be brought into force in stages over the coming year, and there are also developments affecting public sector exit payments. Add to this the holiday pay cases, which will once again gather momentum with the Court of Appeal hearing in Locke and British Gas on the 11th of July. There's plenty to get to grips with. With me to discuss these key developments is Expert HR Employment Law Editor Laura Merrilees and Managing Editor for Pay and HR Practice Sheila Atwood. So we've got to kick off first with Brexit, Laura. What issues are employers going to be dealing with in the aftermath of the result?
Well, I think a big issue will be dealing with employees who are non-UK EU nationals who may be concerned about their job security. Employee morale may well be affected as the economic fallout continues, and employers may decide to delay hiring new staff until it becomes clear what the government's policy on migration will be.
And it's important to point out this stage, isn't it, that the normal rules are going to apply in relation to recruitment, i.e. the existing law on discrimination still applies.
Yep.
So looking at the first issue then, how can employers deal with those kinds of concerns from EU employees who are worried about their job security?
Well, I think the key is to reassure those employees, remind them that until the point of exit from the EU, which may not be for some time, there should still be free movement of people, but obviously don't make promises you can't keep. The reality is that we don't know what's going to happen at the point of exit. If you haven't already done so, it's a good idea to communicate a company message to staff to acknowledge the outcome of the referendum and to ensure the channels of communication are kept open so that staff know who they can talk to if they have concerns. Expert HR has a model statement for employers to use to communicate the outcome of the referendum to their staff.
And inevitably, you're going to get situations, aren't you, where employees strongly disagree with each other about how people should have voted.
Absolutely, yeah. Tensions among the workforce may well be running high, and you'll need to deal with any instances of what's known as Brexit bullying in the same way that you would any other type of bullying. Remind employees of your policy on bullying and harassment if you have one, or if not, remind them of the expected standards of conduct at work and the consequence of breaching these.
Okay, and Sheila, what can we expect to see in relation to pay awards given Brexit?
Well, the key here is going to be the extent to which Brexit affects the economy. So pay awards at the moment, they tend to be based on what organisations can afford to pay. So if we have this dip in economic growth that people have been talking about, that's going to put downward pressure on employers' pay bills. Of course, we're already in a period of low pay growth, so at the present time, I'd say that really this pattern of low pay growth and wages is likely to continue.
So at the moment, there's lots of uncertainty still. Those of you who listened to our special podcast on Brexit a few weeks ago with Darren Newman may remember that Darren agreed to come back after the referendum to look at the outcome in detail with us. And Darren will be back to discuss the implications of Brexit in our live 60-minute webinar, which is going to be on Wednesday the 13th of July, where he and the rest of the expert panel will discuss the next steps in the Brexit process and what it means for UK employment law. The webinar will also include a Q&A session, so you'll have the opportunity to have your questions answered then. Okay, so leaving Brexit to one side for now then, let's look at the other big employment law changes coming up. Can we start then with the Trade Union Act? I understand, Laura, that some significant changes were made to the bill during its passage through Parliament.
Absolutely. Some of the key provisions that we first saw in the bill have been watered down, and we're now dealing with an act which is perhaps less draconian than originally anticipated.
Although it's not yet in force, as I understand it, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It was enacted on the 4th of May, so we aren't expecting any changes to the legislation, but it hasn't in fact yet been implemented. We understand that it will come into force in stages over the course of this year and possibly early next.
So turning first to balloting thresholds, can you take us through the new requirements?
Okay, so in basic terms, currently a union has to obtain a simple majority of votes in order to proceed with industrial action. But under the Act, this has changed. So for all ballots, whether in the public or private sector, there will need to be a 50% turnout threshold of those entitled to vote, and then a simple majority of those voting will need to vote yes in favour of the action.
And then there's an additional requirement for public sector employers, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. So for employees who are normally engaged in the provision of important public services, in addition to the 50% threshold, threshold and the simple majority, there is an additional requirement that 40% of those entitled to vote in ballots related to important public services must vote in favour of the action.
So that begs the question then, what are important public services?
Well, we're waiting for regulations and guidance from the government to define them. What we do know is that it will include areas such as health, education, transport and fire, and it is not intended to apply to workers who are ancillary only, so say back office staff, support functions.
And there's been talk around introducing electronic balloting for industrial action. So what's the latest on that?
Yes, you're right that this has been discussed, which is hardly surprising given that doing things by post is not the norm these days. The Act doesn't, however, commit to the introduction of electronic balloting. What the government has done in the Act has committed to carrying out an independent review of electronic balloting in 6 months' time.
So we might expect the review to launch around November time?
As far as we're aware, yeah.
OK, so moving on to industrial action, what's changed here?
Well, we have a doubling of the minimum notice period for a strike action from the current 7 days to 14 days, although in fact, by agreement, this can still be a 7-day period provided that the employer agrees.
OK, so provision for employers to have a longer time to get prepared for a strike. Any other changes?
Yes, there are changes to the voting paper. The detail that currently needs to be included in the voting paper is basic. This has to now be more detailed and include, amongst other things, a summary of the dispute. But perhaps just important to flag here that it's not as detailed as was originally anticipated in the bill.
So a watering down there of a provision, as we were mentioning earlier. What about the ballot mandate? In effect, the period within which a union has to take industrial action in order for it to be lawful?
Well, that's changed. Currently, provided that the industrial action kicks off within 4 weeks of the ballot, industrial action can then pretty much be carried out indefinitely at any time off the back of that ballot. The government were keen to introduce a finite period for action, but there were some changes made to the original bill, so what we have ended up with is a period of 6 months, meaning industrial action has to start and finish within 6 months of the ballot. Although again, if you have employer agreement, that period can be extended up to 9 months.
Okay, so moving on to picketing, what will we see coming in here?
Well, unions will now be required to appoint a picket supervisor who must be readily identifiable at the picketing location. So for example, the picketing supervisor would have to wear an armband, and he or she will also need to have an authorisation letter and be familiar with the code of practice on picketing.
And I've heard about some changes to check-off in the public sector, so the system where for public sector employees union subscriptions are deducted directly from pay. I think the original intention was to abolish this altogether, but was this also an area where there was some backtracking by the government?
Yes, that's right. For new members, it will still be possible to operate check-off in the public sector, but subject to certain conditions, for example, providing alternative means of payment, such as direct debit. And the union will also need to make reasonable payments towards the employer's costs of operating check-off. So it's going to take some time for employers to sort this out administratively, and for that reason, the government's delayed implementation by 12 months.
Thanks, Laura. There's a lot to get to grips with, so look out for an upcoming podcast on the site soon, which will be dedicated to these and other changes under the Trade Union Act. OK, moving on then, Sheila, where are we now with gender pay gap reporting?
Well, we're still waiting for the final version of the regulations. They're just in draft format at the moment. We expect this final version to have more detail on which employees are to be included and more detail on the definitions of pay and a bonus.
So can you just quickly remind us who is covered by the regulations?
Yes, at the current moment they are for private and voluntary sector employers in Great Britain who have 250 or more employees.
So not the public sector then?
Well, not at the moment, no, but the government has said that it will extend these regulations to cover the public sector, perhaps under the public sector equality duty. So employers in this sector, they can be thinking about their gender pay gap now, but they don't have to report on it just yet.
So for those employers that the responsibility does apply to, when will they have to start reporting?
Well, these employers are going to have to report on their gender pay gap as well as their gender bonus gap. Now, the key date for pay is the 30th of April next year, with pay at that time being used to generate this first gender pay gap figure.
And what about bonuses?
Well, obviously, organisations can pay a bonus at any time of the year. So the regulations specify that the calculations must be made on bonuses made in the year from the 30th of April 2016. So bonuses being paid at the moment will be included in those calculations.
So what will employers need to do once they've made those calculations?
Well, the government's thinking here is that if organisations measure their gender pay gap and then they make those figures public, then the issues are more likely to be addressed. So the employer must publish these figures on their website, and they're also going to have to upload them to a government website. At the very least, this is going to be tables of where the gender pay gap is presented by sector. It may also be searchable for individuals.
So people will be able to clearly see the gender pay gap in each organisation?
They will be, yes, but you know, the figures only tell half the story, so the government is really encouraging organisations to produce a narrative to accompany those figures.
Okay, so what might that narrative look like?
So this is the commentary on the figures, and it allows the employer to do a couple of things. Perhaps if there's a significant gender pay gap, it may want to explain why and what it's doing to address that. Conversely, if there's a lower gender pay gap than nationally or perhaps in their industry, you know, the organisation should promote this. It's useful information for both the current and future employees, and it's good for the employer brand.
Absolutely. So you've mentioned that employers should be collecting data on their bonus payments at the current time. Is there anything else they can be doing now?
Well, all employers, those in the private and voluntary sectors already covered, and the public sector looking ahead, could do a dry run of their pay data. So the calculations are relatively straightforward. They should be possible to run from existing payroll software. And this will enable organisations to see where their gender pay gap currently is, perhaps whether they want to do anything about that gap before they officially have to publish their figures, and also start thinking about what their narrative might say.
Now, moving on to the public sector, I understand there's a fair amount of activity around exit payments, is that right?
Yes, in two respects. Firstly, around repayment of exit payments, so when someone leaves and rejoins the public sector, and secondly, in relation to the imposition of a cap on the amount that someone can be paid when leaving the public sector.
Okay, so looking at the repayment provisions first, tell us about these. First off, are they in force yet?
No, not as yet. The enabling legislation is in force, so that's the Small Business, Enterprise and Employment Act 2015, but we're still awaiting implementation of the actual regulations, being the Repayment of Public Sector Exit Payment Regulations 2016. We understood from the government that it would originally be April of this year. The latest that we have from the government is that we can now expect it shortly.
And what can we expect when they do come in?
Well, in summary, the provisions apply to employees who earn £80,000 or more. If such an individual receives an exit payment on leaving the public sector and then moves to another part of the public sector within 12 months, that individual will be required to repay that exit payment.
And will they be required to repay all of that payment?
No, not necessarily. It depends when in the 12 months the individual takes up the next job in the public sector. So there's a sliding scale which reduces the payment down over the 12 months.
And will it apply to a return to any part of the public sector?
Yes, it will. So an individual could leave, let's say, the NHS and join local government. It's also important to note that it will apply to those who rejoin as contractors or off payroll.
So what sort of payments are captured in the repayment provisions?
Well, perhaps as you'd expect, redundancy payments are included, so that's both voluntary and compulsory. Payments under the balance of a fixed-term contract, settlement agreements, they all fall within scope. It's worth noting, though, that employer payments to provide unreduced pensions on early retirement are also included, even though these payments aren't in fact made directly to the individual.
Okay, that's interesting. And what payments are excluded?
Well, there are two key ones to mention: payments in lieu of notice and payments resulting from incapacity due to accident, injury or illness.
And how is this all going to work in practice?
Well, the outgoing employer will need to keep a record of the exit payment and other details for a period of 3 years. The employee will also be obliged to inform both the old and the new employer, and the new or hiring employer will not be permitted to take on the employee until the amount has been repaid or the employee has come to an arrangement to repay it.
Okay, so the admin around this is going to be key, in particular starting to get those record-keeping obligations in place. So moving on to the cap on exit payments, tell us more about this.
Well, again, we've got the enabling legislation in place, and that's the Enterprise Act 2016, but we're still awaiting implementation of the final regulations, and those are the Public Sector Exit Payment Regulations 2016.
When are they likely to come in?
Well, we know for sure that it won't be before the 1st of October this year, so we're looking at maybe October-November time.
And what does that cap impose?
It limits the total aggregate value of an exit payment to a public sector employee to £95,000. What's included within that cap? Well, there are similarities to the repayment provisions, so redundancy, settlement agreements, and again, the unreduced pensions and early retirement. It's worth noting, though, that also in this case, payments in lieu of notice do form part of the cap.
And are there any exclusions?
Again, we see injury or ill health related payments and accrued but untaken leave as being excluded.
So I understand this might not be the end of the reforms affecting public sector exit payments.
Yeah, that's right. The government's recently consulted on the formula for calculating exit payments in the public sector. So this has looked at, for example, imposing a cap of 15 months pay for redundancy, a maximum salary to be imposed when calculating redundancy payments. But we've no news as to the if and when reform in this area is likely to be implemented.
OK, well, we'll be updating the site when we have more information on this. Turning to Sheila again, let's move on to the apprenticeship levy now, which is also due to come into force next April.
That's right, yes. So from 6th of April 2017, all employers, so across all sectors in the UK, will have to pay a levy of 0.5% of their pay bill. But there is a £15,000 annual allowance, so in effect, actually, only those employers who have an annual pay bill of more than £3 million will have to pay it.
And the levy will be used to fund apprenticeships.
That's right, yes. So the government really wants to increase both the number and the quality of apprenticeships, and the levy is really designed to help them meet this target. So employers must use the proceeds of this levy to pay for training and assessment of apprenticeships, and most specifically, employees who are following an approved apprenticeship framework.
So how will employers access the funding?
Well, we are still waiting for further guidance on this, but we do know that employers in England will have a digital service account into which the government will also top up the levy by 10%, and that will enable the employer to keep track of the funds in their account and also give them access to training providers.
So we're less than a year away from this coming in. So what can employers be doing to prepare now?
Well, firstly, and probably most importantly, is budgeting for paying this levy. It's going to need to be paid monthly via the PAYE system. Don't forget, if you're looking at it now, include any likely pay rises you're going to have before next April in your calculations. But also bear in mind that from April 2016, employers were no longer liable for Class 1 national insurance contributions on apprentices. So do take that into account.
Okay, and how can employers make the most of the levy?
Well, at the simplest level, employers are only going to get out what they put in if they take on apprentices. So now is a good time, perhaps start thinking about the skills and the jobs needs in your organisation and which of those could be met by an apprenticeship. Now, the levy funds will be time bound, so employers are going to have 18 months from when the money was paid in to spend it. So really start thinking about this now so you're ready for when those first payments go in next year.
OK, so don't hang around once you've started paying the levy then. So what about those employers that don't pay the levy? How can they access funding for apprenticeships once this is in force?
There will still be government funding available for these employers towards the cost of apprenticeships, but they will have to contribute themselves under a system known as co-investment.
So you mentioned that this is due to come into force next April. So where are we with the legislation?
The regulations, again, are still in draft format and will be introduced in the Finance Bill 2016. We were expecting some provisional guidance on funding from the government around now. This has been delayed, perhaps due to recent events. But the government has said that the draft funding rules will be published in October this year and then finalised in December. Also in December, we will get guidance on calculating and paying the levy.
Thank you, Sheila. Some good practical advice there on how employers can already be preparing for the apprenticeship levy. Finally, Laura, can you just give us a brief overview on the holiday pay cases, particularly those involving commission and overtime? I believe we've got the hearing in Lock and British Gas coming up shortly.
There seems to have been a never-ending saga on holiday pay, but yes, you're right, the Court of Appeal is hearing the appeal in Lock and British Gas on the 11th of July. So in a nutshell, these cases all stem from the requirement to pay a worker when he or she goes on holiday under the Working Time Regulations 1998. The basic position under the regulations is that a worker needs to receive normal remuneration during a period of annual leave. But this begs the question, how do you calculate normal remuneration when pay varies, you know, particularly where a worker, say, works overtime or earns commission?
So what have the courts looked at?
Well, going back to an earlier decision in the case of British Airways PLC and Williams, the cases really flow from a finding in that case that payments should be included in the calculation of holiday pay if they are intrinsically linked to the performance of a worker's duties.
So how has that principle of being intrinsically linked had a bearing on, say, the inclusion of overtime?
The leading case in this area at the moment is the case of Bear Scotland Limited and others. And this case concerned workers who were obliged to work overtime when it was offered, but had no guaranteed right to be offered it. So it was compulsory, but non-guaranteed overtime. And these workers were not receiving any overtime payments for periods when they were on leave. They took their case through the courts, up to the Employment Appeal Tribunal, and the finding was in their favour.
Meaning overtime should be included.
That's right. Even though it was non-guaranteed, it satisfied the intrinsically linked point. It was sufficiently regular, there was a reasonable expectation that it would arise, etc. Interestingly, a subsequent decision in the Northern Ireland Tribunal, although non-binding in England, Wales and Scotland, has found that voluntary overtime should be included where it was normally carried out and an appropriately permanent feature of the workers' pay.
So practically, what can employers take from this?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the direction of travel is to include rather than exclude, particularly where there is any degree of regularity and it's pretty much part and parcel of the worker's job. I think where overtime is genuinely ad hoc, so it's occasional, there's no expectation, etc., and importantly, the worker wouldn't be deterred from taking holiday due to a loss of overtime pay, then there is a good argument to say it doesn't need to be factored into the holiday pay calculation.
And commission. You mentioned the case of Locke and British Gas and the appeal, which is coming up shortly.
Yes, similar principles to Bear Scotland. The EAT found that commission should be included broadly based on the points we've just discussed. However, the case is being appealed to the Court of Appeal, so that's a higher court, and it has the potential to overturn the earlier decision.
We'll be keeping a close eye on how that develops, and indeed we'll have a dedicated podcast on this following the Court of Appeal hearing on the 11th and 12th of July. Well, thanks very much, Sheila and Laura. You've given employers plenty to think about, and we'll be keeping the site updated as all these developments gather pace. A good first port of call is the Legal Timetable, which provides summaries of pending employment laws and regulations with effective dates. And don't forget to also register for our Brexit webinar that I mentioned earlier, which you can do by going to our Brexit Hot Topic page, which you'll find on the right-hand side of the Expert HR homepage. When you register for the webinar, you can also submit your HR questions on Brexit. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast, which you've been listening to with me, Ellie Gelder. We're back again next Friday, but until then, it's goodbye from us.